Okay, Clinton, Erev Shabbos, everybody. We're continuing in our shir that we're calling the Chasen Shmuz, You Wish You Had, But Never Had. And again, a couple of points I think is important to make clear. I may have to make this hakdama every single time because in the world of internet and the random learning that people do, someone might just listen to this year out of context from the others. So I feel it's very necessary to make the same akdama each time. Number one, to understand that this is not a halacha shir. I'm not a posik. I will quote you different Jewish sources that is my understanding, and it's really, I'll always give you the source. So it's really up to you to look that up and also to ask any shilas that you feel that may come up from these discussions. But these discussions are about ideas that we find in the Torah and also some things that they come from my experience as a therapist. I'll share it and I'll identify that as my opinion coming from my experience. And again, that information is something that you use in a way that could be helpful to you or not. That's a very important point. The second thing that I always feel is important to say is that really this is not quite in the bounds of sneers to speak so frankly in a public forum, especially something that's on the internet. We really don't know who's listening to it and what their motivations are. At the same time, because there's so much confusion and so much difficulty that people have, and a lot of shame in coming forward on an individual basis, I do think it's important to talk about these things, and we will continue to talk in a fairly frank way. And it's truly a hirasha, and at the same time, considering all the garbage that's on the internet, I would say that this would be the least of anybody's problem. Okay, so last week, people may recall, oh yes, and one other important point is you can text any questions to 718-793-1376. That's 718-793-1376. That's during the shiur. And if you ever want to email questions, which people have done so far, and I appreciate that because that actually helps shape the shiur, and I'm hoping that the questions that people are asking are representative of the silent majority who are not asking questions. But you can email to me questions, comments about the shiur, etc. simchafeuerman@gmail.com. That's simchafeuerman@gmail.com. And we look forward to and appreciate your comments. Okay, so last week, we discussed in the shiur a number of points that were raised by somebody who had sent in an email, and without totally going into all the details, the main point that the person was raising was that he was in a very difficult marriage where there was not a lot in the way of sexual affection. And then obviously it created a very big difficulty for him, and that there's a challenge between maintaining sobriety and maintaining responsibility for sobriety. There is some background noise, I'm not muting because I want people to have a chance to ask questions if they do. But I'm asking on your own phones that you mute it so that we don't have the background noise, please. For some reason, the background noise is still there, so I'm gonna have to mute it. There is a way for people to unmute it. I think *6 if they want to make a comment, but I don't know how to do that. But I'm gonna have to mute it. Hold on. Okay, I believe that if you do want to make a question or comment, you can press *6, and I think it allows you then to do that. But now I muted everybody who don't override that. Okay, so in that letter in that email, the person basically spoke about this marriage that he was in, and the upshot of last week's shir was, without going into, again, to repeating it, was that essentially I made a point that normal sexual function and normal intimacy is a very important need in a marriage. And I made a metaphor. I said, if you know, imagine if you were in your house and there was a 3-foot hole in your ceiling. I guess an anxious and nervous person might yell or scream at their spouse or make accusations, but a relatively healthy person would simply say, we have a problem over here. It's not manageable, without pointing fingers, but we need to solve the problem. And even if they didn't have enough money to solve the problem, they wouldn't just throw their hands up in despair, or if they didn't know how to fix it, or if they went to one carpenter who said, I can't fix it, they wouldn't throw up their hands in despair and give up. Why? Because it's obvious that you cannot live in a house without a roof, and they would keep working at it, or they'd leave the house. So what I was pointing out is that people tolerate dysfunctional intimacy and dysfunctional sexual intimacy because there's a shame, there's a feeling that somehow or another that they don't deserve it, and perhaps also, especially for those who have engaged in all kinds of compulsive and problematic sexual behavior, there's certainly a feeling of shame and illegitimacy that they don't deserve it. But in point of fact, they do deserve it. And in point of fact, it's very important to recognize it as a vital need of the marriage. So in response to that, somebody sent in a couple of questions that I really think will help clarify the inyan. I think that these questions may be questions that not just this one person was asking, and that's why I'm going to discuss it. I think it was very helpful for him to write these questions because I think it will clarify more. So he had a number of them, and we're going to take them one by one in response to last week's shir. So first of all, question number one, he said, was, I understood that the requirement of ona means that a man give his wife sexual affection, that requirement of ona is in the ksuba, and the obligation is on the husband to the wife, but not the other way around. So this person is saying, isn't it the obligation of the man to give his wife a sexual attention and not the other way? And the answer to this, according to my understanding, is that that's not really correct. Now, this requires some discussion. There is a mitzvah saseh in the Torah. Well, actually, it's a lo saseh, to provide sexual attention for the wife. Now, it comes in Shmos Perachaf Aleph Pasuk Yud, where it talks about, actually, if a man will take on another wife, even though the first wife was of some lesser status. I don't want to go into the story over there, but there's a lot of reason to believe that the first wife was of lesser status and might be ignored. And so the Pasuk says, Im acheres yikach lo, if he takes a second wife, and in those days they did practice polygamy, so she'era kasusa v'onosa lo yigra, he cannot lessen any of the rights that the first wife had. And one of those rights is onosa, which means literally her appointed time, and that's a euphemism for showing sexual attention toward her. And this is also brought down in Simon Samach Tes in Evin Ezer, and that is in fact the halacha that the man is obligated at various degrees of frequency, which are outlined in Shulchan Aruch, but basically according to a reasonable schedule, he's obligated to give his wife sexual affection and attention. Now, that's insofar as the mitzvah goes. However, there are other categories of obligation that are not mitzvahs. There are debts, there are rights. And according to the Torah, each spouse, the man and the woman, under ordinary circumstances, has no right to withhold sex from the other. So, for example, the Gemara in Adarim on Pei Aleph Amud Beis wrestles with how is it possible for a woman to make an oath not to have sex with her husband, because one cannot prohibit with a neder something that they don't have ownership over. And since the right to sexuality is jointly owned, she doesn't have a right to prohibit it. So the Gemara goes into a whole explanation of how it's done on a technicality, but the point is it's very evident that that there is, under ordinary circumstances, an obligation and a right that the woman not withhold sexual affection from the man. Also, in Eben Ezer, Siman Ein Zayin, Sif Beis, it's detailed, again, that under ordinary circumstances, if a woman forbids or holds back sexuality from her husband, it could be grounds for divorce. Now, the man has similar obligations, and that's discussed in the Dharma and Tesvav and Beis. But the point is that there's a difference between the mitzvah and the Torah and an obligation and a debt. It's like saying if I owe somebody $100, that's not a mitzvah, even though they do talk about paying back a loan as a mitzvah, but that's a separate point. The debt itself is not a mitzvah. The debt itself is an obligation. And a man and a woman who are married have an obligation, once again, under ordinary circumstances, assuming they're both healthy and their relationship is both healthy, they have an obligation not to hold back affection. And we should ask, why is there a disparity in any case? Why would it be that it's a mitzvah for the man to give his wife sexual attention and it's not a mitzvah in the reverse? You might then draw the conclusion that it's less important that the man have sexual pleasure than the woman. That would be a logical conclusion. However, I submit for you that that is an incorrect deduction. And let me explain why. Many times in the Torah goes out of the way to protect the vulnerable person, the person that might not get what is their due. So, for example, in Shmos Perchof Beis, Pasachof Aleph, the Pasuk says, Kol almano v'yosom lo sa'anun. Every widow and orphan, you should not mistreat. So the Torah is telling you not to mistreat a widow and an orphan because these are vulnerable people. They oftentimes don't have financial resources, and they certainly don't have status or prestige in the community. And so they're vulnerable. And the Torah says you should not mistreat them. Now, Rashi over there says something very important and fundamental, which could be generalized in many other areas in the Torah. He says, Hu hadin l'chol adam? What do you mean you cannot mistreat a widow and an orphan? You can't mistreat any Jew or any person. Actually, he says Adam. You cannot mistreat any person. Ela shadibra akosav behova. The Torah was speaking about what usually occurs. L'fishahem teshushe koach. L'davra motzoy la'anosam. Because they are weak, psychologically, emotionally, even physically, therefore, it is more frequent that they will be abused. So what Rashi is saying, and this is fundamental, Rashi is saying that if one mistreats a regular person, even imagine if the widow were to mistreat some peer of hers who was not a widow, she would violate the law. She would violate the prohibition of do not mistreat the orphan and the widow, because the Torah is not saying that those are the only ones. The Torah is saying that these are the ones that we're very concerned about because they're vulnerable, so we're going to highlight them. So too, the Torah is worried about a woman's ability to have her sexual needs met because she is far more vulnerable to not having that met than the man. For psychological and physical reasons, they are, generally speaking, less dominant in the relationship, so the man can find a way to have his needs met. But even further, even not even going to that point, the context of the original command that the man provide his wife with sexual affection, that command in the Torah is talking about in the context of a man who, like I said, married a wife of lesser status. She used to be an Amal Ivriya. She used to be a maidservant, if you look at the psukim over there. And then he takes on a second wife. So how easy would it be for him to ignore his wife of lesser status, meet all of his own sexual needs with the second wife, and ignore the first wife? The Torah is saying, no, don't do that, because she's vulnerable. You may not neglect her needs. So you see, the Torah is simply talking about the vulnerable population. It might even be possible, if you were to really go on a limb here, and I'm not telling you this is true, but it might even be possible, just like Rashi said, that if you mistreat the any ordinary person, aside from the widow and the orphan, you still violate the prohibition. It might be possible, I don't know, that maybe if the woman withholds sexual attention from the man, that she also violates this prohibition. That would be a very big chiddush. So I won't go that far, although it's possible. But the point is, one way or the other, the fact is there's a disparity in what the Torah chooses to highlight and make as a specific mitzvah doesn't indicate that the other side is less important. What it does indicate is that this side, that the woman's need, is more likely to be ignored because of her vulnerability, social, physical, emotional. So therefore, the Torah makes a point of making it into a mitzvah. However, there is no such thing, conceptually or otherwise, that the woman does not have, under ordinary circumstances, a responsibility to give her husband sexual affection as well. So let's just let go of that belief. And I think that's clarified here. Now, the person raised a second question. He said, according to your metaphor of having a gaping hole in the roof, it doesn't work when one party doesn't realize or acknowledge that there's a hole in the roof. If the wife thinks that the situation is normal or that the husband is overreacting, sometimes there's a disparity between one person's sexual appetite and another. So, right, the wife might say, you just need it a lot. I don't need it that much. A person can't be forced to get help, especially if they don't feel that there's a problem in the first place. So this is the person's question. And it's a fair question, and it's an important point. And here is how I would respond, based on what I know. First of all, it's definitely true that a person can't be forced to get help, and there's all kinds of reasons why a person may not be interested in being sexual. There could be preferences, there could be trauma, there could be resentment, there could be all kinds of things. So who really knows, right? But the metaphor is still valid, because my point is that if you lived in a home and there was a 3-foot hole in the roof and your spouse refused to acknowledge it, so I don't know where everybody else is here, but in New York right now it's really cold and it's snowing. So imagine living with somebody and there's a 3-foot hole in the roof and it's freezing cold and the snow's coming down and you're saying it's freezing, and the spouse is saying, oh, no, it's perfectly warm here. I'm very comfortable. Spouse is walking around in her pajamas. So would you tolerate it? Would you tolerate such a situation? I'm not saying that you shame or guilt or yell at the other person, but would you tolerate living in such a situation? Obviously not. Obviously, you would do whatever it takes to try to have a mature and reasonable discussion and say, we have a problem over here. I can't live like this. And not only that, but if the person would not be able to respond to you, you would get whatever help it was to try to solve the problem. And if nothing would work, you still would not allow yourself to live that way. And that's my point. My point is not that you should yell and scream or shame or tell the other spouse, it's a mitzvah, you owe it to me. That's all ridiculous. You can't force anybody into anything. But neither not does that mean that you should let your shame about needing something, which is fundamental and vital to life, allow yourself to ignore that. And here it's important, I think, to digress for a moment about a dynamic that affects many troubled marriages. Imagine where one spouse behaves in a way that's really not acceptable or not manageable. Even say, for example, the spouse is an addict. So one spouse is an addict and doing all kinds of destructive things. Or imagine there's a spouse that suffered some kind of trauma, doesn't want to admit it or own it or work on it, and is not able to be emotionally intimate, physically intimate, etc. And there are lots of children involved, and there's a community involved. So divorce really seems like an impossible thing because there's so much shame, and you're going to hurt the children. And getting help doesn't seem to work because the other person is in denial, right? So what do you do? It's a very fair question, and I don't know the backgrounds of the listeners here, but I'm willing to bet that there's at least one listener or maybe more. in something that resembles that situation at whatever level of intensity that it may manifest itself. And here's where there's a very interesting dialectic, which is that you can have two truths operating at the same time, which is that in order to have a healthy marriage, in order to really truly have a healthy marriage, you need to have a connection and a commitment, and at the same time, there needs to be freedom and emotional independence to not put up with what you can't put up with. So it's a very, very strange paradox. On the one hand, you need to be utterly committed to each other, no matter what. And on the other hand, if for whatever reason it becomes intolerable, there should be enough emotional dependence that you could pull it away. You know, I'll explain to you how this plays out in the ideas of Chazal. So, for example, the Gemara Ksubas on the Nevavim Adbeis says that if a man has intercourse with his wife and she doesn't have a ksuba, it's considered a bi'ilas nus. It's considered like a promiscuous sexual act outside of the bonds of marriage, a casual, immoral sexual act. Why? They're married. The answer is, Rashi says over there, lo havasamcha daita, a ksuba. She doesn't feel any safety. She doesn't rely on the ksuba. What does the ksuba do? The ksuba is very important. The ksuba is basically an insurance policy, because if the man chooses to divorce his wife, he has to provide her, which was in those days, a relatively large sum of money that provided her a degree of financial security. So it means that a man could not just get rid of his wife at any moment that he was unhappy with her. Furthermore, if he chose to do it, he would have to provide her with reasonable financial support. So that created a certain sense of safety within the marriage. When there's safety and obligation, a marriage works. The minute people don't feel safe anymore, the marriage doesn't work. So that when within the bonds of marriage, there has to be a commitment, but at the same time, a feeling of safety. And safety means that I don't have to put up, and I will not put up with that that's impossible to put up with. Now, there's an interesting Gemara in Megillah on Daf Yudalad Amud Aleph, which tells a story. As you all know, Haman convinces Ahasuerus that the Jews are an unnecessary people, and they're trouble, and they're seditious, and so at that moment, Ahasuerus gives over the signet ring to Haman and lets him do whatever he wants. So Omer Rabbi Abba Bar Kana, Gedol HaSaras Tabas, at that moment when the ring was taken off of Ahasuerus' finger, that was greater and more instructive than the 45 Nevi'im and the 7 Nevi'os who were pounding away at the Jews to try to do tshuva, and to no avail, they did not listen. But that one gesture that Ahasuerus removed his ring and the Jews found themselves to be in mortal danger, then they finally did tshuva. So all the talk, all the rhetoric of all the 48 Nevi'im and the 7 Nevi'os accomplished nothing. But this one act where the Jews felt the mortal danger, that was when they finally did tshuva. That's what the Gemara in Megillah on Yedaot Amud Aleph says. And I think that there's a great metaphor over here. The relationship of the Jewish people with God is oftentimes compared to a marriage. And so in every marriage, sometimes the ring has to be taken off, meaning that in order to effect a change, and this can't be a threat, because threats don't work, it has to be a fact, and it can't be through yelling and screaming, and it can't be through shaming, it has to be straight, which is that there is a situation here that is unmanageable, and I cannot manage, and I'm willing to try every which way possible to work with you to solve the problem, but I cannot stay if the problem is not solved. That's the taking off of the ring. That's the taking off of the ring. That oddly enough and paradoxically enough, a marriage sometimes can only be healthy if a person is willing to say what their limits are and what they will not put up with. So if you have a spouse who's an addict, a spouse who's verbally abusive, a spouse who's so emotionally damaged that they're not able to meet your needs and they're refusing to get help, if they're not refusing to get help and they're getting help, this is your mazel. The Gemara says in Ksubas, I forget where, Nistav Chasadeu, this is the first like two or three blot in Ksubas. After a man gets married, what happens to his wife is his mazel also. So if your spouse is ill and they want to work on the problem, that's not your, that you have to put up with, that you have to help. But if they refuse, there's a point where you say, I cannot take it anymore. And I'm not attacking and I'm not blaming you. I'm just telling you, we need to come up with a plan to solve this problem because the problem is not manageable. And that's what the Gemara says. Taking off that ring is worth more than all the rhetoric in the world. Now, item number three. The person asked another question. He said, I understood that the correct sexual relationship is one of giving to the other partner. If one is only really interested in his own satisfaction, how can the wife be expected to maintain interest? This is a very important point. At a later date, I hope to devote at least one shiur to the topic of the obligations toward one's spouse in terms of sexual satisfaction and pleasure, and also what it means toward meeting their own needs. However, at this point, I just want to say that in response to this question, of course, in marriage, it's very important to make your spouse's priority your priority, and really even more. So what your spouse identifies as a need, even if you don't really agree with it or like it, you should treat it equal to your own priorities and maybe more. So for sure, one has to be very concerned that their spouse's sexual needs are met. And quite frankly, if somebody is not interested in sex, sometimes that's as a result of many years of disappointment and frustration. And that needs to be unraveled and dealt with, and absolutely. But the fact that one has to put one spouse's needs equal and possibly greater doesn't mean that one ignores their own. And in a relationship where one feels that their sexual needs are being so drastically ignored that it's not sustainable, then something must be said, like we spoke about. Item number four. The person asked a fourth question as follows. Now, I don't follow the 12 steps, he said, but my understanding of it is one of the key principles is that sex is optional, not compulsory. Well, it's not exactly in the 12 steps, but I think what he means is that part of the step work is being able to take responsibility for your own behavior and not trying to control somebody else. Before I even answer the question, I just want to make a comment to that letter writer and also to anybody else who may be in the same position. I don't know why one would say I do not follow the 12 steps when they're in so much trouble, because actually the 12 steps oftentimes lead the person down a path of development and growth and concern and connection and making amends and all those wonderful things that eventually opens up new doors. And that in and of itself might change the dynamic of his marriage in ways that he never imagined. So I don't even understand how he could be asking this question and prefacing it with saying, I don't follow the 12 steps. Well, you know, chuvoso betzido, it might be worth doing. But leaving that alone, yes, there is a point that we are responsible for our own sexual behavior. And there are many times in life where a person, for one reason or another, is going to be deprived of an appropriate sexual outlet. No question about it. There are many times in life where that happens for all kinds of reasons. That's a part of life. And when that happens, we have a responsibility to manage ourselves. During those times, you practice acceptance, you use whatever tools are available to manage your impulses. To simply blame a person's spouse is just deflecting responsibility. At the same time, though, that has nothing to do that does not absolve a person from using every kind of emotional, tactical, financial, and any other kind of resource to resolve the problem, because a person's in a terrible nisayon. Now, there's a very big difference between acceptance and giving up. Acceptance, which is good, means letting go of anger and other control behaviors. But hishtadlus, with an appropriate connection to the will of Hashem, is not being controlling. It's just not giving up. And there's many examples about marriage and how important sexuality is in marriage and how marriage is not sustainable or viable without sexuality. In Siman Kuf Pei Zayin, in Shulchan Aruch, it talks about a woman who's in an unfortunate situation where, for whatever reason, it was established, and we won't go into the details of how, that she's a raw mechamas tashmish. That this woman, for whatever reason, enters into a state of menstruation during the sex act. And if that's established, obviously, intercourse is forbidden. So the halach is that the man has to divorce her. There's not an option available for him to stay married to her and not be in a sexual relationship with her. That is not an option. Or, for example, in Evin Ezer, Simen Kuf Tezvav Sivches, it talks about a woman who is declared to be a sota, that there's some clear evidence that she committed adultery, and now because of that, she's forbidden to her husband. Now, there's no option for that man. If he's forbidden to have relations with her, he must divorce her. There is no such thing as having a marriage without sexuality. There's no such thing. Now, of course, when there are psychological barriers, the aim is to repair the psychological barriers, so it's not a full comparison, right? The Torah doesn't expect a person to get divorced. The Torah expects the person to work on resolving the sexual barriers. But my point is, and this is very important to hear, my point is that it is not contrary to the 12 steps to practice acceptance and understand that for the moment you are not able to have your sexual needs met and therefore you must find a way to manage those impulses, and at the same time to be working in every which normal and practical way to resolve the situation, and not only that, but to not be willing in the long run to live in such a relationship. There is no such Torah value to live in a relationship that does not allow you to have sex. And it may even be prohibited to do so. Now, on a practical level, to this person who wrote the letter and to any other listener that is relevant to, my advice would be to work the 12 steps hard and to achieve sobriety for 90 days. And after that, and I'm not saying this person didn't achieve sobriety, I have no idea where they're holding, and I certainly, you know, wouldn't presume. But once one is in that state, then you're mentally adjusted and you're in a good place and you've probably been treating your spouse better. And then hopefully under the guidance of a competent mental health professional or possibly a very skilled and knowledgeable Rav, it really needs to be a Rav who understands what goes on in situations like this, you can begin to confront the spouse gently and firmly both, about the absolute unsustainability of the situation. There is no reason that a person should have to stay in a marriage where there is no hope or option for normal sexual behavior. Yes, like I said, if there are emotional barriers, wounds, traumas, resentments, and there's an openness to working on it, that's exactly what one should do. That's very important. We must do that. However, if there's no openness and there's utter refusal or utter denial, there's no such obligation. And the way to deal with that is to work on yourself first, make yourself into the best possible person, and then without anger or shaming or blaming, simply say that this is not a manageable situation. So we're gonna wrap up. I'm going to unmute in a minute and shut off the recording. Again, if people do want to email questions for future discussion or comments on this particular shiur, that they're welcome to do that. It would be simchafeuerman@gmail.com, simchafeuerman@gmail.com. Hold on a moment.